Okay, good evening, everyone. We're continuing our Bible Building Blocks series. This is class number 10. Last week we began, at the end of the class, we began Parshas Chaye Sara. And as we see on the sheet here, Chaye Sara is a very short timeline from the year 2085 to the year 2088. Last week we discussed how, subsequent to the binding of Isaac, we come across the death of Sarah. And her death was as a result of the binding of Isaac. How that exactly happens, we talked briefly about that. We also talked about how the Avram had to purchase the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, which is in Hebron, the double cave, from Ephron for 400 silver coins. Again, Hebron is in the news this week. The slew of apartments in one of the sections in Hebron, from the old Arab Shuk that was originally Jewish until 1929 for hundreds and hundreds of years.
It was bought by the Sephardim.
Yes, and when the Arabs slaughtered them in 1929, the Jews left, they stole their property and took over the market there. And then after 1967, the Jews got it back, whatever, and slowly the Arabs were leaving those markets, and the Jews refurbished them and built them into one-bedroom apartments. I think it was 9 or 10 apartments, and our community was one of the communities that paid the money to build one of the apartments. There's a sign, the Westmount House, so to speak. So anyway, for whatever political reasons, the government wanted to evict the Jews, because supposedly there's no permit, although there's thousands of Arabs with unpermitted property that the government is choosing to cast a blind eye. For some reason, the Israeli government doesn't want to cast a blind eye to that. So they came to an agreement that the Jews will leave, and 2 months later, new Jews can go in. Go figure that one out. It's a lot better than what happened in Amona. In Amona, they just knocked them all down and came in with batons and clubbed people and horses and everything. So, okay, at least Hebron had a little bit better. So, you know, I don't think Avram Avinu, our patriarch, Father Avram, would ever have imagined that these kinds of things would be happening in right where he's buried, that Jews would be sent out by Jews. It's a very scary thing. And that's why it's important to learn your Torah and to know how special what we have is, so you wouldn't want to make those kinds of mistakes. Anyway, so that is the death of Sarah. It's interesting, before we go on to the rest of the parsha, just to focus on an interesting thing. So why do you think Sarah died? So the simple understanding is that, well, she was told that she thought that her son almost died. So she thought he almost died, so she died from fright. It's very difficult to live with that. The reason being, not that we, God forbid, are minimizing the love that Sarah had for her child. There's no question about that. But you'd think she would be stronger than that. You'd think she would be strong. She went through a lot in life, Sarah. Did not have an easy life, abducted twice by enemy kings. Her husband had a fight many times to save them. There were a lot of difficult things. She went through 90 years without having a child. She had to deal with the Yishmael in the house. It was not exactly a bed of roses. And, you know, just to, so to speak, die from fright, just doesn't seem to be the right ending for such a woman's life. So we'll just share with you an idea that maybe will give you a deeper appreciation for what she died for. There's an interesting midrash that tells us the following, that the Satan dressed up, impersonated Isaac. And as the personality of Isaac, he approached Sarah and related the story of how he is almost slaughtered and wasn't slaughtered. That's what the Midrash tells us. Which only begs the question further. So how could she have died, hearing that he almost died, when it was her very own son that was telling her that? So the answer is like this. As we said last week, that the whole point of this 10th test was everything was riding on the 10th test. All the spiritual improvement to the world that Avram was able to bring was happening through all the 9 tests, and the culmination would come in the 10th test. So, Yvonne, you could sit next to your husband. It's okay. I don't mind if you pass in front. It's okay. He'll be happier if you sit next to him. He always smiles more when you're next to him, you know? So certainly this 10th test was critical. And certainly if a person is so dedicated and loyal to God, you know, it's very interesting. You know, one should love God with all his heart, all his resources, all his life, all your soul, as the Shema says. So really, there would be philosophically a concept that one should be willing to give his life up for God. And you could see how perhaps people could think that even human sacrifice would be a positive thing on one hand. Because after all, that shows our ultimate surrendering before God. And, you know, a person should, human sacrifice, you could hear from a certain philosophical point of view, would be a very religious thing to do. And perhaps it'd be a very religious thing to do is to take the most precious thing that you have, your child, and sacrifice. Now we know that Judaism frowns on that. And Judaism tells us in other places, sorry, you're not allowed to do that. And instead we use an animal. And through the animal, we'll talk about that later when we get to the book of Vayikra, we play it out through the animal, that the animal is a representation of the human being, but we don't play it out on the person, because it doesn't help to kill a person, because then the person can't serve God anymore. So it's just not a practical way of serving God. However, perhaps there might be a case to be made for that in a unique type of situation. What if this human sacrifice would be the tool to bring the Mashiach? What if you were told, you know, make the ultimate sacrifice, and through the power of this ultimate sacrifice, the Mashiach will come immediately? Now, if you look carefully, if you read the text, it's interesting. When Avraham told the youths that he was going up with Isaac, he says, we're going to go up to the mountain. And then he says, and we'll come back. Now, Avram's not a liar. Why would he say they're going to come back if he knows he's going to kill his son? So the rabbis suggest that Avram understood that quite possibly that the killing of Isaac would be that step to bring us that closer to the Mashiach in a very real way. And yes, we wouldn't normally kill people in the service of God, because that goes against serving God. But if this could be an exceptional case, because you don't get better than Avram and Yitzhak, and it could be this ultimate sacrifice, could be that which will bring the Mashiach, which will bring us, we call in Hasidic world, the Tikkun Olam, the repair of the world. He's willing to make the ultimate sacrifice, and when you make the ultimate sacrifice, that will bring the Mashiach. So Avram was fully cognizant, and he felt that that is what was going to happen. And Sarah certainly was no less religious than Avram. So you can imagine when Avram is taking Yitzchak to the altar, and he binds him, and Avram raises his hand, he's ready to slaughter. Then he hears the word to stop. You know what? Avram stopped. But then he started asking, he says, I don't understand. What's the problem? What's the problem? Is there something wrong with my intentions? You know, a lot of times when a Kohen, when a priest does service in the temple, when he brings animal offerings, if the priest would have the wrong intention of what he's doing, if he's not totally dedicating it for God's service, that would render the whole offering invalid. So Avram is wondering, he says, did I do something wrong? Was I maybe second-guessing God in a way that would invalidate what I was doing? And Avram frankly felt that God telling him not to sacrifice his son would be indicating that, Avram, you failed. Because even though you're going through the motions, but your heart wasn't in the right place. And how could one know if one has a bias or not? And therefore, when Avram raised, he says, are you sure? It's not like he goes, oh, great! And he starts dancing, he says, What's the problem? Why can't I finish the job? And God says, no, I didn't want you to do it. But God, Barak says, but I got to do something. If I don't do anything, that means you've totally rejected what I was supposed to do. Okay, so God says, okay, fine, I'll bring a ram and you can slaughter the ram. So what's the answer? So if mystically they say, really, the mystics say, had Avram slaughtered Yitzhak, that would have been the ultimate step that would have brought the world extremely close to the Mashiach. That's way beyond our simple understanding, but that's the ultimate sacrifice. It's not good enough just to test him, have him go through with it. And he goes through with it, he kills his son for God. It's a unique case. God would never ask it again from anybody else. But that would be the ultimate dedication of the human being to God. And that would bring a tremendous correction to the world. And very, very quickly the Mashiach would come. I mean, very quickly. And Avram probably understood that. And Avram felt he was a failure. So then God said, I just want you to know, Avram, it's not that you're a failure, but the rest of the world is a failure. Sometimes a tzaddik can do something unbelievably great, but if the rest of the world doesn't understand what he's doing, it could be counterproductive. And what God said to Avram is, it's not that you weren't worthy, it wasn't that Isaac wasn't worthy, the world is not ready for that kind of step to happen. Okay. Now, let's back it up. Now let's go to Sarah now. Yeah?
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah?
Does this diminish Avram's test at all? If Avram
really
felt this is Mashiach, then is he making the sacrifice or is he just doing... He knows Yitzhak is going to come back to him.
No, because still, killing your son is killing your son. It's not exactly a pleasurable thing to kill him. You know, God says, well, you know, this is what you got to do to bring the Mashiach. Okay, but why do I got to kill my son?
Mashiach would be Yitzhak reborn as well.
He'd be reborn, but there's a lot of faith. You got to have a lot of faith in that. Sure. I mean, one thing is clear. You kill someone, he's dead. For him to come back to life, I mean, we've never seen it yet. So even if God says, Avram, you kill him, and you know what, we'll resurrect him. And he says, what is that? Okay. You know, and that takes a lot of faith. And number two, I don't think it's going to be so painless for Yitzhak. They didn't have drugs to anyone. So it would not be an easy thing. I don't think any parent who said, listen, kill yourself and he'll come back to life. I don't know how easy that would be. Right? I don't think it minimized the test at all. Anyway, that's what happened. So now let's play out Rivka's, Sarah's scene. Sarah's raising, sleeping with a husband, trying to develop Avram into being the person he's supposed to be. She's raising a son, Yitzhak, for 37 years, trying to develop him into the person he's supposed to be. And she knows that they're groomed for greatness. And obviously, if this 10th test was important, when Sarah finds out that there's a 10th test going on, she realizes how important it is. And when Yitzchak says, and even if according to the Medrash it says it was Yitzchak who came to her, and Yitzchak says, you know, God gave me and Daddy a test. And me and Abba took me up to the mountain, and Abba was supposed to slaughter me. And Abba was ready to slaughter me. And then God said no. At that point, what registers in Sarah's brain? They failed the test. They failed the test. Her whole life's mission was a failure. She died from the tragic thinking that they failed the test. If they failed the test, that's, in other words, her son dying wouldn't cause her to die, but her son and husband being failures would cause her to die out of grief. So that's a deeper interpretation. In other words, the Jewish mother, she lives for the spiritual growth of her husband and her children. And if they're failures, and that's why you'll find more often, it used to be 100, 150 years ago, you know, Jewish mothers would have more anxiety knowing that a child left Judaism than if they were killed in a pogrom. Not to say that they didn't cry over children who were killed in pogroms, but they would mourn much more for children who would give up their Yiddishkeit. So certainly that's a deeper way of understanding why Sarah lost. It was the shock of thinking that her husband and son failed the test. Was a tremendous shock to her spiritual system, something that she couldn't recover until, and obviously Satan set it up in a way that she would be misled to think that way, and that would cause her death. So that really is the greatness of Sarah, and that's what Jewish mothers really cry and die for. Okay, so yeah?
There might be another possibility. I mean, Sarah was there to help Avraham through his life. If this was seen as a success, that he passed the test, Could it then be that Sarah no longer needed to live because Avram didn't need her to help anymore, so she could die? Is that another way of?
Okay, so another way of looking at it, that's a good point you're raising, Paul. Another way of looking at it is once Avram does pass the test, then Sarah's mission's been accomplished. In other words, she's lived to the point, I mean, how long does a person live until their mission's accomplished? She brought a child into the world. He came to the point where he fulfilled the test. So she's basically, done her role. Her role's finished. And it's a time to die, and as we said last, it becomes an additional test for Avram afterwards, as we said. So that's why she dies at that state in time. And as you'll see, Avram and Sarah, basically after the binding of Isaac, basically move out of the picture as their mission as patriarchs and matriarchs are finished. And now we wait to see the next generation. Okay, let's move on to point number two now. So now that, there is no Jewish mother in the home, we have to find another Jewish mother. So now we come to the second story in Chayisara, where Avraham requires that Eliezer, his trusted servant, make an oath and to find a wife for Yitzchak. Yitzchak is an extremely holy person. He's born in the land of Israel. He is not permitted to leave the land of Israel, as we'll see in the next parsha as well. And therefore, there's only one option. Someone has to find him a wife. So you could ask, well, they're living in the land of Canaan. There's probably not a lot of wonderful women in the land of Canaan where he lives. Yitzchak can take a trip to one of the cities and find a wife. And Avram says, no one in Canaan is worthy for Yitzchak. Where are we going to find someone worthy for Yitzchak? We got to go back to my hometown. Got to go back to the other side of the Tigris and Euphrates, and we have to go back to Haran, where I was raised, my birthplace, where my family is, where you're going to find Besuel and his family and his children, and we're going to have to find a wife for Yitzchak. So Avram's too old to take the trip. Yitzchak can't leave, so Avram has to have someone to take the trip, so he sends his trusted servant Eliezer to get the job done. Now, it's interesting, the rabbis ask a question, there's a number of questions that have to be asked, so Eliezer is going to find a wife. How's he going to know if she's the right wife? How's he going to know she's the right wife? And more than that, you know, and Avram's pretty clear, it's got to be from this family. You're going to go there, you're going to find someone from there. The question is, well, what if they're idol worshippers? I mean, he hasn't, you know, they don't have like email to check on how they're doing recently. He probably hasn't seen them for many years. And idol worship was pretty big in the world. How do you know that this one won't be an idol worshipper? So the rabbi tells something very interesting. You know, this is in the beginning of life, as the Jews are just developing. We wouldn't say this now. I wouldn't recommend you finding a daughter for your son who's an idol worshiper. But the rabbis say, you know, idol worship, especially in those days, was really a function of misunderstanding and not really understanding the concepts. And idol worship, you can prove to someone that they're making a mistake. It's an intellectual thing. It's an intellectual mistake. And you can correct intellectual mistakes. You can prove to them that God exists and there's no other forces. And Avram did a very good job at that. But it's something much harder that you can't change so easily. And that's called midos tovos, good character. And Avram knew that the people who lived in the land of Canaan, who were descendants of Ham, were people without good character. They were people who were lustful people, not the good characteristics that are necessary. And this would not be good for Yitzchak. We were looking for a mother of the Jewish people. You can't get a mother from the Jewish people from people who don't have good character. In the land of Haran, the descendants of Avram, and descendants of Terach, his father, and the three sons that he had and the people that they married, etc., etc., these were people who may have been idol worshippers, but they had much better character than anybody else. And he said, if anywhere I'm going to find good character traits, it's going to be there. So even if you find a woman who's an idol worshiper, I don't have to worry about that. As long as that person has good character. And the truth is, you know, even today you can find this. You know, a lot of times, you know, unfortunately we have intermarriages and things like that. And certainly it's very complicated, those things. But the truth of the matter is, you know, quite often when there's intermarriages, but the people that you're intermarrying have really good character, it's not unusual that they convert properly according to halacha. Because someone with good character, Judaism can resonate with them. If they have misguided ideas, we can deal with that. But if they have good character, then there's always hope. If they don't have good character, then you're really barking up the wrong tree. And that's what Avram is saying. Character is key. Character is key, and that's more important than anything else. What else we know is, very importantly, we see that Yitzhak is not going to be able to see his bride and have much of a decision in this process of marriage. This is a very important story. This is the first story that deals with marriage. We have not been introduced to marriage, really, in a very serious way up to this point. Adam and Eve, there wasn't much to choose. Okay? God kind of called the shots on that one. Many people were married, but the Torah doesn't talk about it. This is the first at-length story Torah talks about marriage. There's a lot to learn about marriage from this story, a lot to learn about shidduchim, dating, and things like that. So let's spend a couple minutes about this. Now, it's interesting, as we'll go through the story, maybe we'll just go through the story a little bit, and then we'll come back and learn the lessons of marriage that fit in over here. So Avram says, Eliezer, you got to take a woman from that part. Now, you got to remember, Eliezer had an agenda. Eliezer, some say Eliezer himself was Kenan, the son of Ham, a Hamite. Right? Remember what Noah said about Ham and Kenan? Cursed is Kenan, right? For the terrible things that the selfishness that he had. God turned him black when he came out of the ark. So these are cursed people because, you know, they're very selfish, self-centered, etc., etc. The Medrash says that Eliezer was Kenan, grandson of Ham. And he was the most unbelievable trusted servant of Avram. So then Eliezer says, okay, Avram, you know, okay, so I'm going to go halfway across the world. I'm going to go find a woman, and I'm going to suggest to her that she should travel all the way to the land of Canaan, meet someone she doesn't know, and get married to him. Ulai, perhaps she won't want to go. What do I do then? As if to suggest, and then maybe he should marry one of the Canaanite women. And by the way, he doesn't say this, but it's implied, by the way, Eliezer had a daughter of marriageable age that certainly he thought would be very appropriate to be married to Yitzchak. And all things being equal, maybe that's so. And he didn't say that. He just said, but perhaps, in the Torah, they write the word ulai without a vav, that can be read as well to say Eli, to me. And therefore, Avram got the hint. He says, in his mind, he says, oh, I mean, if we don't find anybody there, maybe then my Yitzchak can be married to your daughter. To which Avram said, I've freed you from responsibility, but he's not going to marry anyone from Canaan, and especially not your daughter, because you come from a cursed lineage. And a cursed lineage cannot mix with a good lineage, with a blessed lineage. And that's what he told straight to Eliezer. Now that could be very deflating to a servant. The servant said, okay, I understand the message. And Avram says, I want you to make an oath. You swear that you will keep this word 100%. And Eliezer did. He swore and he did. So now you can realize many of us, if we had agendas and we understood that our agenda got blown out of the water, that might, so to speak, take the steam out of our desire to accomplish the goal. And what we're going to see with Eliezer, that it's not so. Yeah, question.
Two questions. I'm just going from memory from the Chumash. Did Abraham not specify to Eliezer that it had to be someone that Abraham knew was in his family?
From his region and extended family.
Okay. And when Eliezer went through the desert on the way,
yeah,
did he not talk to God and pray to
God? We're going to come to it. We're coming to that now. We're coming to that now. Okay? So Eliezer understands what he has to do. He understands he's out of contention. He's out of, no matter how he slices it, he's out of the running. Okay, so now, number one, he hooks up 10 camels with all kinds of goodies, all kinds of wealth, because of course he's gonna have to persuade the future mechutanim, to wanna get married. You gotta give presents. So miracle number one, a trip that would take many, many days, he accomplishes in one day. He has miraculous speed in his trip, and in one day he's there, and he's wondering to himself, how am I going to find the right woman? I have no idea how to find the right woman. How am I to judge character? So he says, he prays to God. He says, God, I need your help. God, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to the city. I'm going to come to Haran. I'm going to come to the well. And I'm going to see the girls as they come out to water there, that get water. And I'm going to ask a girl to help me out, to give me a little water. Give me a little bit of water. The woman who not only gives me water, but will give water to all the camels that I have, and there's a lot of camels, and camels drink a lot of water. If she offers, without me asking, to give to the camels as well, then I'll know it's a sign from God that this is the woman to marry Yitzhak. Okay, that's a pretty outrageous thing to ask from God. But on the other hand, he had a very difficult task. And more than that, he understood that he was biased. And he says, you know, if I'm biased, you know what, I'm pretty sure I can't trust myself. And whoever I will think that I'm doing the right thing, some on the back of my mind, I might want to just sabotage this mission. Or I might not give it my full effort. So God, you know, I'm coming up with a reasonable plan. So God, it's up to you to make sure the right woman comes. So lo and behold, as soon as he finishes the prayer, Rivka. Medrash says she was 3 years old. Don't ask me questions. How can a three-year-old girl do this? All I can say is they were quite mature in those days. A three-year-old was different, was totally different physically developed. You have the occasional story now and then, even today, where you got, I remember this one story with like this five-year-old who was a genius. And he was in university writing all kinds of incredibly complex equations. So, you know, even now you get the occasional unbelievable prodigy. And in those days, you know, life was different. The maturity levels were different. The Medrash, from the Torah, we find that she was 3 years old. So, okay, be that as it may.
Rabbi, is there value to know that?
Is there value to know that? Well, not necessarily. It doesn't go out of its way to tell us. You just mathematically figure it out. See. We know she was born when Sarah died. And we know that Yitzhak was 37 when she died, and he was married at 40. So she could only be three.
Someone told me there's another theory. If you calculate it,
yeah, I know, but 19. Yeah, I know, but I don't accept that one. I don't accept that one. So she comes down, and as this story goes, that's what happens. He says, "Can you give me a little bit of water?" And now he's watching her, and she says, "Yes, I'll give you water, and then I will give all your camels water." And she's rushing, she's running, and she's pouring the water for him and pouring for the camels. And the Torah says, Elias is watching and he's amazed. He's amazed that all these things are playing out right in front of him. He says, this must be the woman. So he says, where's your father? She runs back home to her father, Besuel, and says, guess what? Somebody's here. Now, Eliezer was such a dedicated and devoted servant to Avram. The Medrash tells us that his whole physical features changed to look like Avram. He became so dedicated over the years to Avram, he physically manifested Avram's looks. So he comes into the tent, and Besuel figures, this is Avram. And he figures, I'm going to honor Avram. And he says, Avram, you've come to find a match for your son? How wonderful. And Eliezer says, hold on, let me tell you my story. And then Eliezer goes and repeats the whole story. The Torah writes every word of it. Verse after verse. Avram made me swear and I came this and I made a condition and I was, said she came and this and that and the whole thing. And he started off right away saying, I am the servant of Avram. I am the servant of Avram. And I tell you the whole story. And they listen to the whole story. Meanwhile, in the back room, Besuel is not such a very nice guy. And what does he see? 10 camels loaded up with wealth. Unbelievable. And he realizes that they're going to want his daughter. Well, a guy like him who's not exactly the most righteous guy in the world, okay, and he has a son, Lavan, who we'll learn more about in the next couple weeks, okay. So what do they plan in the back room? They plan to poison this fellow. And the poison is being prepared. And where do they put the poison? In the soup. Obviously. And while Eliezer is saying the whole story before they can stuff him with the soup, so while he's going through the whole story, an angel comes along, switches the bowls, and instead of Eliezer drinking the bowl, Besuel drinks the bowl, and Besuel dies from the poison that he laid for Eliezer. Now, why do we need to know that? Well, it'll explain why later you see that Lavan becomes the big macher and not Besuel. But more than that, you see that Eliezer's honesty saved his life. Because you can imagine, you walk into a place and they think you're somebody else. Now, and you're getting a lot of honor from that. You know, people would be very tempted to say, yeah, I am Avram, right? But he had to be honest. He said, no, I'm not Avram, I'm Eliezer. And I better explain myself. During the time between that confession that he's Eliezer and the explanation is when the soup got changed. And that really saved his life without him even realizing what happened. But that's an important thing to remember. And he finally says, and they realize, you know, all of a sudden Basul, croaks in the back of the house there, and they realize, there's some special things going on over here. And the other says, okay, we'd like to take Rivka back home. Now they're not really that excited to have her leave. Because, they want her there. She probably, it's free work. You know, you notice in all these stories, the women did all the work in these places. So they said, we'll have to ask the young woman. And the young woman who realized who Eliezer was, and she realized that this was a great opportunity to marry someone very spiritual. Instantly, she says, I want to go with him. And so they had to accept. And the next day, they went off and returned. And they returned in one day. They come back. So that's just the basic story. Now, what is interesting is they mentioned to Eliezer, as the story was ending, they mentioned, Eliezer, you are blessed. And it's very interesting. The rabbis pick up on this, and it's a very interesting lesson we learn from here. Eliezer, not only are we talking about a shidduch for Yitzchak, but we're also talking a lot about Eliezer. And Eliezer, although he's not Jewish, there's a lot to say about him. And there's a lot of important messages. And the important message is this. There's no such thing as a human being who's doomed for the rest of his life to be cursed. Eliezer, who descended from a cursed lineage, as we learned back Parshas Noach, you gotta go back to Parshas Noach, we talked a lot about that, why shame couldn't control, Chum couldn't control his lusts, and Chum was the one who castrated his father so he wouldn't have other brothers and wouldn't have to share the wealth of the world. Very selfish was Chum, and we said the curse was he'll be a slave. Or Canaan. Canaan is cursed. He will be a slave. That Canaan is Eliezer. Eliezer is the slave. He's cursed. Remember, the one who is selfish can't have anything. He can only be a slave. What the Torah is teaching us in the story of Eliezer, how the slave who is cursed, if he's a devoted servant and dedicated to his master and dedicated to giving, can transform himself to no longer being a cursed individual, but to be a blessed individual. And it's a very important idea that gets lost in many of the classes that are given on this. They talk a lot about everything else. But realize the transformation. Eliezer, the non-Jew, there's much hope for the non-Jewish world. And there's a lot of growth for the non-Jewish world. And although you can be born in a narcissistic society, and you can come from descendants who are extremely selfish, but if one can put oneself in a situation of service to a master, not our wrong notions of slavery, and they have no rights, and we beat them and take advantage of them. Judaism never espouses that. But to have a genuine master-servant relationship, where the master, like Avram, guides them on how to be a mensch, and the servant knows that, you know what, your job is to be a servant to him, to serve him, to enable Avram to do more kindness in the world, and you're totally subservient to this person. You can transform yourself, as Avram said in the beginning of the Parsha, you are cursed. And really, just like everybody has their tests, this is Eliezer's test. Do you think Eliezer went through a lot of tests in his life? When Lot was captured, Avram faces 2.6 million soldiers. Who was on his side there? Eliezer. Okay? A lot of things Eliezer did with Avram. He went with him all the time. And whenever Avram was in danger, Eliezer's in danger. So it's interesting that just like the 10th test added in the last Parsha, but then this week's Parsha is like post-10th test tests. And Avram had his post-test with the death of Sarah. So Eliezer still has what to grow. And at this point, it would seem clear, Eliezer, what would he want but to have his daughter marry Avram? Can't be any worse than Hagar. Hagar was a descendant of Chama also, and Hagar got to marry him. And you'd figure Esther should say, well, I'm much better than Paro. My daughter's much better than Hagar, and Sarah isn't alive anymore, and we need another person to take over. She's been living in Avram's house for years. Who could be better than that? So God, in the storyline of finding Yitzhak's appropriate spouse, he's not forgetting about fixing up Eliezer. And I think it's very important. The Torah is not exclusively talking about Jews. And there's many significant stories about non-Jews because there's many important lessons for the non-Jewish world as well. And although many of the non-Jewish world, as we've seen in the early classes, they descend from really terrible sources. And that could tend to be part of the negative spiritual DNA that can exist with them, but no one's doomed to that forever. And Eliezer, by being the dedicated servant to Avram and assisting the tzaddik and helping the tzaddik change the world and selflessly working with the tzaddik, what eventually happens to Eliezer, although he was cursed in terms of character, but he could change it. And through this selfless act of being moser nefesh, really risking his life, because you see how dangerous it ultimately was, they wanted to kill him. He's willing to risk his life knowing that no matter what he does, his daughter is off the table and not negotiable. And he has to do everything for Avram. He does exactly what is asked of him. And even to get a little credit at the end, because they think it's Avram, even that he doesn't take for himself. So what does the Torah say at the end? He transforms from being the cursed to the blessed. He becomes the blessed. He becomes a person. No, he's made it. He's perfected himself. He's accomplished his mission too. So Eliezer has a kind of happy ending, so to speak, as well. And that's an important lesson for us to realize our relationship with the non-Jewish world. To the extent that we can get the non-Jewish world to assist the Jewish holy people in getting the work done, these people's lives are improved and their quality is improved to that of being blessed people as well. So that's a very important idea. Okay, now let's just get a little bit into the... Yeah?
Eliezer is a Jewish name, so how come
it's here? Now you see what you're asking. Eliezer is a Jewish name. I got some interesting questions. You're opening up a Pandora's box with this.
It's my name, though, so I'd
like Eliezer, so what do you see? So Eliezer, although he's rooted as a non-Jew, but he was able to perfect himself and be a blessed one. Let's go even better. We don't have this nowadays, but if you look in the Talmud, there's reference of a rabbi named Rabbi Yishmael.
Yeah.
In the Talmud, you have Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yishmael. But we'll see, Yishmael did do tshuva. Right? So there's certain aspects of the non-Jewish world, when you perfect those aspects, they can be assimilated into Judaism. What Eliezer was able to accomplish, remember, Eliezer is a servant of Avram. He had to be circumcised too. When everybody got circumcised, Avram circumcised himself, Yishmael, all the ones that were there, all the quote-unquote converts, whatever you want to call them. I mean, Eliezer was sort of a convert, right? But didn't make it into mainstream Judaism, so to speak. We say he's a righteous Gentile. And so righteous that he was, and that he passed this test, means that he has incredible qualities that Jews could be part of at the end of it all. Had he failed that test, there would be no Jews called Eliezer. So it's interesting how his sacrifices become part of what Jewish consciousness can relate to. So that's fantastic. So let's talk a little bit more about, so, and then let's just finish up. So what happens the next day? They're coming back. And they're coming back quickly, and they're coming back towards as the sun is setting. It's the end of the day, and Yitzchak's out in the field. And the rabbis say, what's Yitzchak doing in the field? He's davening mincha. Yitzchak institutes the afternoon prayer. He's davening for a shirch. The shirch should go well. As soon as he's finished praying, who does he see in the distance? He says, Eliezer and Rivka are coming. And he's introduced to this Rivka. Torah says, what happens? Yitzchak, they say he marries her, he brings her into his house, and he loves her. In that order. He marries her, brings her into his house, he brings her into the tent that was his mother's tent. We know that when Sarah was in the tent, many miracles happened in the tent. The dough never got spoiled. The cloud of glory was over the tent. The Shabbos candle that she lit on Friday lasted the whole week. There were guests all the time. When she died, it all stopped. And then when Rivka came back, it all resumed. So a very important lesson is, this is the first marriage that the Torah is really talking about. And look at the order it says. He married her, she came into his house, and then he loved her. Very important lesson. There's no such thing in Judaism as love before marriage. It doesn't exist. The Torah is saying it doesn't exist. All of you thought you loved your fiancés that you married. The answer is, that was not love. That was, infatuation, which is masquerading as love. And you think it's love because all the people in the music business have told you that it's love. And many poets have told you that it's love. But in Judaism, there's no such concept as love before marriage. That's ridiculous. It's not possible. Because the definition of love in Judaism is not the idea of romance, which is from the French root word, which means fiction. Okay? Romance is fiction. That's not reality. Right? That's not the real life. But love, as we know, love is spelled ahava. Ahava has a numerical value of 13, which is the same numerical value as the Hebrew word echad, which is one. And love in Judaism means that a husband and wife are one. When you're at one, you're inseparably one. That is love according to Judaism. They say the famous story with Rev Aryeh Levine. Very big, he was called the Tzaddik of Jerusalem. Tzaddik of Yerushalayim. Right? So he was older, he's in his 80s, his wife's in his 80s, and we married a long time. They go to the doctor, and he comes to the doctor. The doctor, his wife has a problem, so they ask, so Rabbi Levine comes in, so the doctor says, we have a problem. My wife's leg is hurting us. Right? My wife's leg is hurting us. Meaning to say that they had been so close that if her leg hurts, it hurts him too. And that's really what the goal of marriage is all about. The goal of marriage is to work and develop to reach the state of being one. And that is the state of love. Anything that you have before is that which merely brings the two together. And it's not reality. It doesn't maintain the two together. That has to develop to a new stage, and when that new stage happens, and generally that new stage takes many years until it comes. It doesn't come after the honeymoon, it doesn't come after the first year of marriage, it comes after a number of years of marriage and working hard at becoming one, then you get that stage of being one. But yeah?
It wasn't that in all the societies, all the times until the modern time, that people never got married because of love. That's right.
And traditional Judaism until recently, what happened was parents would get together and they would decide, boy meets girl. According to Halacha, the bride and groom must see each other at least once before the wedding and agree. Okay? They, you know, if the woman would be totally repulsed by the man, we couldn't force her to get married, right? Or vice versa. But generally, the groom has to see the bride because maybe he won't like her. So they see each other briefly, and they agree, fine. And generally that was so. And this leads us to a very important aspect of what marriage is all about. The rabbis tell us, you know, Eliezer really didn't know so much about Rivka. Rivka didn't know so much about Yitzchak. And you know what the rabbis say? It really doesn't matter. You don't need to know too much. As long as you have a commitment to get that goal of being one, it basically doesn't matter who you're getting married to. I know people have a lot of trouble with that nowadays because everyone's a lot more selfish than they used to be and they're forgetting the goal. But it's a lot different, and that's what they're saying. You know, the Chassam Sofer talks a lot about this. Is that people spend a lot of time trying to find out about people to such a point where they feel that everyone has to be so similar that they think it's going to be the best marriages. And the truth is, it's not necessarily so. Which leads us to an interesting point as we look at, now we have two generations of patriarchs and matriarchs married, and you'll notice something very interesting. There's a concept in marriage, there's a concept in spirituality, that the mystic term is called chug. Ches vav gimel. Ches stands for chesed. Gimel stands for gvura. We've told you those terms, and the vav is the combination. Chesed is the person with kindness, giving, expansiveness. Vur is a person of self-control, judgment, strength of character, willing able to self-control oneself, not to give so freely. Now, what's very interesting, the rabbi says like this, in every marriage between a man and a woman, the optimal marriage will have one spouse will have chesed, and one spouse will have gvura. And that's the optimal scenario that you're looking for. If this is where the where we get the term incorrectly applied, opposites attract. We like to use the term opposites coalesce. In Judaism, opposites coalesce as opposed to opposites attract. So let me explain this for a minute. We'll explain to you why. When first man existed, God said, before he created the woman, Lo tov heyos ha'adam levado. It's not good for a man to live alone. Therefore, I will create a helpmate opposite him. What does that mean? It means like this. If a person lives alone, that's a bad state. Why is that a bad state? It's a bad state because every person will be stronger in one aspect in life. And that, by definition, means a lack of balance. For example, you have a person who's very kind. Being very kind is wonderful, but it has to be balanced. If you are single and you're kind, you're imbalanced. If you're strong in gvura, in control, in being strong and justice and that, you may be very good at it, you're imbalanced. It's not good for a person to live alone because they're imbalanced. So what do you have to do? You get married to get balanced. So now, look what happens. Let's say you have a young fellow, he's Mr. Chesed, and you have a young woman, Miss Chesed, the kindest man and the kindest woman, and they get married, that's a disaster! Because not only was the groom imbalanced before he got married, and not only was the bride imbalanced before she got married, now they're both married and they're more imbalanced! Because they both are exactly the same zone! And therefore a house that's, we'll call it a chesed house, is going to be a home where anything goes. Because the parents are going to be so kind, they can never say no. And the kid does whatever he wants. And they're not going to control it. It's going to be a hefker house. Because the father says, yeah, you want the keys to the car? No problem. But they're only 14, but how could I say no? And the mother says, you want some drugs? How can I say no? I love you, right? And there's everybody's just giving. And the kids become selfish, spoiled kids. And it's a credible imbalance. On the other hand, you have Mr. Gvura, Mr. Control, rules. Everything's got to be exactly the way it's supposed to be. And Mrs. Control, they get married. Those kids are going to be terrified. They're going to be repressed. It's going to be a house where there's going to be all kinds of abuse, verbal abuse, all kinds of, and you know, you can never go out of the house. It's 6 o'clock a day. You can't go out of the house until you're 40 years old, you know, and the kids are so repressed because there's so much structure in this house that could structure the kids to death. So a chesed house will have kids that will be Woodstock children, right? And a gvura house will be a military academy. It's a terrible thing. The optimal relationship is when one spouse personifies chesed in a strong way and the other one personifies gvura in a strong way, and then the two realize that each one has a different strength, and as they together become, they love each other, as they become one, then some of the chesed rubs off on the guy with the one with the gvura, and some of the gvura rubs off on the one with the chesed, and then you get balanced children. You follow? You get balanced children. And therefore, it's not ideal for to have a bride and groom be exactly similar. Now, in certain ways, of course, they should be. If you're an Orthodox Shomer Shabbos Jew, you should find a spouse who's Orthodox Shomer Shabbos. You should have goals that are similar. You know, and there's different levels, how religious you want to be, and there's certain things you should talk about before you get married. There's certain things you have to be on the same page in general. Okay? No, I keep kosher and I don't keep kosher. Well, how are you going to have a home? I want to have 12 kids, I want to have no kids. I mean, there has to be some similarities in the general context. But when we're getting to character, it's much more preferable to have opposites Because as the marriage continues and you stick with it, although the beginning stages are difficult because you have to adjust, and that's where it's, you don't find that love and that unity so quickly, because the guy who's Mr. Chesed says to the wife, who says, you know, the kids can't, 6 o'clock, they can't go out, and the father says, in my house we did this, and the wife says, well, in my house we did that. Guess what? They have to learn to negotiate a good, healthy compromise. And what eventually happens in a good marriage where there's that spirit of compromise is that both husband and wife end up balanced people, and they have children that are balanced people. So therefore, it's not so good to ask so many questions. Now, certain questions you do. If the person has terrible mitos, you want to marry someone with negative character traits. But if the person has positive character traits, but you happen to be a more kindly person, the person is more an orderly person, you know, you have more joie de vivre while the other person is more of a stick in the mud. Okay, that is not necessarily a bad thing. If anything, it could be a very good thing. So you got to be careful. You know, if they both have chesed, both parents, they probably know who's going to watch, who's going to mind the books in the bank. The account's going to bounce every day, right? If they're both gvuraniks, no one's going to give any charity. So you got to have that balance, and that's the story here. Now let's go back a generation. Avram. Avram was the paradigm of kindness. To a fault. So what kind of wife did he have to have? Sarai had to have gvura. Had to have that element of control, strength, justice. And you see it playing it out. If you recall, what happened with Hagar and Ishmael? Who was the one that insisted they get thrown out? It was Sarah. And what did Avram do? He had to give in. He had to give in. So it's interesting, when the wife is a gvura and the husband is a chesed, and we'll, as we go through the marriages, you'll see a lot about marriage comes over here. It was a really good blend. Their one child was Yitzchak. And he turned out good. He turned out good. Now Avram, on the other hand, when he married Hagar, now let's go to this. Avram is chesed, right? Hagar, a descendant of Paro, a descendant of Cham. Cham is selfishness, immorality. We said that immorality is the holy spark of kindness gone in the wrong direction. Remember? Kindness is expansive, sharing yourself, going beyond. What is that concept in a negative way? Yeah, I'm kind to myself. Right, to myself. And I take liberties with every pleasure. I'm friendly with everybody. Everybody's wife I'm friendly with. Everybody's money I'm friendly with. To extreme. Now, Amram is the man of kindness in the holy way. Hagar, a descendant of Paro, a descendant of Cham, which is chesed in the wrong direction. You can see now why they get a Yishmael. It's chesed, chesed, and not only chesed, chesed, but you also got a negative aspect of chesed. So Yishmael, who's telling Yishmael what to do? Nobody. That's why Yishmael became the ultimate worst expression of chesed, and that's the Muslim empire. Right? You see how this makes a lot of sense now? You also can, so now Yitzchak, who was raised, and Sarah had a greater influence on him, and now Avram already blazed the path of kindness in the world, so we don't need another patriarch to blaze kindness. We need a patriarch now to blaze gvura, control, right? Judgment, justice. You don't get anything more than what you deserve. Yitzchak always was worried about that. I don't want to get anything I don't deserve. I got to work for what I get. No free handouts. Not to say he didn't give charity, but he wasn't, and of course he was kind. He had asked, but not the way Avram had. So now if Yitzchak is the man of gvura, what kind of wife does he need? Chesed. He has to have a chesed wife. Right? So now what? That was the test that Eliezer made. Now, let's understand. There's chesed and there's something else called rachami, mercy. What's the difference between mercy and kindness? The difference is like this. And this explains Eliezer's test now. If Eliezer comes and he says, you know, I'm thirsty. Can you give me something to drink? If somebody gives them something to drink, that doesn't mean the person has chesed. It's kindness. That's not kindness. That's mercy. Mercy means you feel terrible that the guy's in such a terrible state. And if I wouldn't have mercy, I'd be a wicked person. But I do just what I'm asked. If a beggar comes to your door and says, I haven't eaten in a week, please give me some dinner, you feel terrible. You give him some dinner. That wasn't kindness. That was mercy. You feel bad. How can I eat dinner knowing somebody's starving to death? I feel so bad. I feel better now that I gave you something to eat. But, you know, you never looked for any poor people. It didn't bother you. But when you see it, you notice it, it becomes a response. Chesed is, I don't look what's missing, and to fulfill what's missing, I look for opportunities to give what isn't even asked. And that's what Avram always was. When Avram was, after the third day of circumcision, he was looking for guests, even though God made it such a hot day that nobody would come. He was upset he had no guests. So Eliezer knows, if we are now trying to bring someone into this home, and Yitzchak is the epitome of Gvura, we need someone who's the epitome of Chesed. The test is going to have to be to see real kindness. What's real kindness? Number one, Eliezer's a big, strong, strapping guy. And he asked for a drink of water. First of all, many women would say, you know, there's the barrel, there's the well, help yourself, Mac. I mean, she's a three-year-old girl. I mean, no matter how developed she is, she ain't as strong as Eliezer. Here's the barrel, I'll share your barrel with you, and drink. She says, no, I will do it. But it's not just what he asks, it's what he doesn't ask. She offers beyond what is asked. That is not to wait to be asked. And that's why Eliezer made that test, because he knew I had to find the ultimate woman of kindness, someone that's so powerful, because Yitzchak was so powerful, Gvura, unbelievable Gvura. You need a woman who's unbelievable chesed to go toe to toe. That you have to measure. If somebody's a little bit of a Gvura, you get someone with a little bit of chesed. You want to, don't want to have something over too much on one that will smother the other one. So, but Yitzchak was a giant of Gvura. So you need a giant of chesed. That's why Eliezer demanded the most amazing miracle. He said, I need a woman who's going to do it all. Not just me, but my 10 camels. That's going to take maybe hours to give them to drink. Then I know I've got an amazing champion of kindness. At that, and instantly he knew this is the girl. He didn't even check who she was. He didn't even know who her father was. He says, this has to be the woman. There's no question in my mind. And that's the perfect match.
So then, go ahead. So then how did he know that she would be that particular family?
He said it's got to be. It's no such thing. This kind of kindness you're not going to find anywhere else. It was like, it's proof positive. It just can't be. It's so unbelievable. It couldn't come from somewhere else. It has to come from that spark. Now you understand why he said, Avram says, you can't marry anyone from the Canaanites. Because the Canaanites, who are descendants of Ham, who are givers, but what kind of givers are they? In the negative way. You can't match a gvura with a chesed of a distorted chesed. That would be destructive as well. So that's why Avram says you can't marry anybody from Canaan, not even your daughter. Not even your daughter. Until Eliezer reversed himself and made himself a blessed person, but at the expense of losing that opportunity. So this is a very, very important parsha about marriage. So critical that, you know, we look for so many things, and the most important thing as a parent is to look at your child and kind of say, is he a chesed child or is he a gvura child? It's either going to be one or the other. And now you're looking, if your child is a chesed, you're looking for a spouse who's a gvura. And if your kid's a gvura, you're looking for a chesed. But in today's society, they do the wrong thing. Oh, we have so much, he's just like me. That's disaster. Doesn't mean to say they're going to get divorced. They may be happy, but they're not going to grow. And their children are going to get messed up. Because they're going to be one extreme or the other. They're not going to be balanced. They're either going to be spoiled rotten or oppressed rotten. The parents will have a lovely time. But they're not going to grow. If they're both stingy, they'll both remain stingy. If they're both, you know, they give everything away, they're going to give everything away. They'll keep nothing for themselves. They'll be impoverished. There's got to be, and today's society that kind of says, no, I don't want to work hard. We live in a society that nobody wants to work. The whole goal of society is not to work. That's the real successful person. What makes a lot of money doesn't work hard. You know, everything is convenience. So I want my marriage to be convenient. I want to make sure that the person I marry, I won't have to do any work in this marriage. This person has the same sense of humor as me, has this and that, is a clone of me. And the truth is, you will be very happy, but you're not going to grow in that marriage. And the whole point of marriage is to grow. Because remember, lo tov heyos ha'adam levado. It's not good to be alone. Meaning alone, not just physically alone, but existentially in one direction. So if you marry someone who's like you, you're still alone. Because you're still reflecting only one aspect, which is good, but it's not balanced. You follow? So the best marriages, and we got chesed and gvura, and it doesn't work. They can't get along. They're not used to this opposite personality, and they're gonna have to learn. You know, the only way we're gonna get along is I'm gonna have to develop a little bit of your qualities, and you're gonna have to develop a little bit of my qualities. And then we're gonna get along. And that's not fun to change. That's the institution of marriage. And Yitzchak understood that. And that's why when he met her, he wasn't in love with her at all. Because he's gvur and she's chesed. Oy vey, this is not gonna work. They come home, they live together for a few years, he gets a little of her kindness, she gets a little of his gvura, and then he loves her. Because then he realizes what she did for him. She now made him a complete person, and he makes her a complete person. And that you love that kind of a person. Okay? I think that's a beautiful understanding. You'll see as we move on with the parshas, also how a wife has to act towards a husband. You notice when you're married, when it's a man chesed and a woman gvura, so what happens if there's a disagreement? So if you're a woman gvura and man chesed, you can go right to his face and tell it to him. Because the chesed guy, like, he ain't gonna fight you. He's a kind fellow. I don't want to call him the henpecked husband, but he's the kind of guy, the wife says, this is the way it is, the way it is. I'm the gvura. I'm the one, the judge. I'm the one that can make the decisions here. It's black and white. This is what we have to do. And, you know, but what about we have to be, not a time for God. This is what we're doing. So you notice Rivka, she goes toe to toe with Avram. You're not sneaking around them. She's saying, Avram, you're wrong. What? Sarah. What did I say? Sarah. Sarah goes to Avram and says, you're wrong. We're throwing him out of the house. Finished. I don't know that. We'll go to God right now. God, what do you say? I'm right. Well, let's go. And that's how you deal. A chesed man can't do it. He just can't do it. So the wife does it for him. Ultimately, and because he had such a wife, and she threw, and he forced him to throw Yishmael out of the house, Avram developed enough gvura that when Hashem told him to sacrifice his son, he could do it. If he would not have been married to Sarah, he would never have been able to do it. Right? So that's why Sarah gets a lot of credit for this. We will see in next week's Parsha, remind me, when Rivka has to deal with Yitzchak and they have differences, Rivka has to use a whole different approach. Because when they're going to have a difference, we're going to talk about it next week, Rivka is chesed and he's gvura. When you have a husband who's a gvura, you can't go toe-to-toe with a gibor. You're going to have big marital problems in that kind of situation. So we'll leave that for next week and remind me to bring that up and I'll point out how these things are happening. Okay? I think that's very interesting, eh? Yeah?
If the spouses are well matched and you've got a chesed and gvura, the children, even though we say that they come out balanced, they're still going to be one or the other as well, correct?
Everyone will always have one more dominant than the other. You know, you of course you're gonna have, we want you to have all these qualities, but there's one you're always more dominant. Alright? And that's fine. But if you have parents that are both gvura, or both chesed, then you're not gonna just be dominant, you're gonna be wacko in that direction. You're gonna have so much of one with nothing of the other. You know, you wanna have 70% chesed, 30% gvura, that's fine. You don't want 100% chesed. That's, you know, it's Woodstock. You're off the chart with that. You can't live that way.
I guess the reason that Yitzchak turned out 100% is because it was a foundation, right?
Was good. It was a good chesed.
I guess my question is that he had both chesed and a gevurah parents, and he turned out 100% gevurah.
Well, everyone develops his own personality. He was gevurah, but not that he didn't have any chesed. He had a healthy amount of chesed to keep him normal. But he had a strong amount of gvura. He was very strong in gvura because he had to develop that. But he wasn't totally Gvura. I mean, there has to be some chesed.
I guess that allowed him to hear the chesed from Rivka.
Yes, yes. But he's a much stronger one, and that's fine. And it's a healthy Gvura. If you have two Gvuras, you could be an unhealthy Gvura. In a negative way. There could be power struggles. You can imagine if two parents are both Gvuras. You can also, what's going to happen, there could be a lot of fighting going on in that kind of house. And now what happens, that becomes negative Gvura, and the children can develop negative Gvura. You see? So even though Sarah was telling Avram what to do, Avram wasn't fighting back. And that worked out nicely. Okay, we didn't even get to finish Chayesar. We have a little bit more to go about the end of Avram's life. And Yishmol, let's take about 5-10 minutes next week, and then we'll spend the bulk of next week Toldos. It's one of my favorite parshas. So, God willing, we'll continue. And you'll be fortunate to get a quiz next week.
Even though we didn't finish.
Well, there'll be a couple that you won't know, but you could read a little bit. For homework, read points 3 and 4 so you can at least answer any questions. Okay, have a good night, everybody.